Welcome, everybody, to episode 73 of the Metabolist 2 podcast featuring David
and Ben.
And this week we are continuing with our five favorite cliffhangers from each Doctor's era. Mm-hmm. So this era will be the third Doctor, John Pertwee, and we both picked five.
I got my five.
Cliffhangers from that most classic of classic eras of classic Who. And we'll see where we get to.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if we happen to duplicate each other, we will say snap and
snap.
Then just discuss them in tandem.
We'll discuss in tandem. Absolutely. So who's going first?
I think you went first last time, so I will go first here with my first cliffhanger pick will be from John Pertwee's very first story, the very first episode John Pertwee filmed. And that would be from Spearhead from Space, Episode 1.
Okay.
The Doctor has just escaped his Auton abductors. He's rolling away in a wheelchair. His mouth has been bandaged. And he falls out of the wheelchair, stumbles through some woods, can't answer the unit squaddy's challenge, who goes there? And then the other unit soldier shoots him. We see the Doctor clutch his head and collapses.
And he's only just woken up.
He's only just woken up.
And now he's collapsed again. Yeah.
Well, he's been shot at.
Shot at, like, with guns, by his...
By UNIT!
By his extensive friends at UNIT,
yes.
Exactly.
So, that's my number one. We start out with the very first cliffhanger, the Pertwee error.
And it's a good one. It's a good one, as far as if memory serves. It's a goodie, yeah. No, he's only just woken up. We don't really know who he is. He's not done much.
Nope.
Apart from wake up, steal some...
No, he hasn't even stolen clothes.
He hasn't stolen the clothes, has he? No,
yeah,
he's still in the wheelchair.
So the pacing is much more... It's noticeably quicker here. It's only a four-part story that Bob Holmes put together, and
right. It's
a lot snappier pacing than with the capture and escape that we had just in the previous 10-part Doctor Who story of the War Games.
Right. So why have you picked that as a good cliffhanger?
Because we have our new lead actor, our new Doctor,
and
he hasn't done much. We haven't seen him do much. And we end with him potentially
dead again,
being shot or being, going down for the count. And who knows what will happen. The show is remarkably different at this time, and we don't know what's going to happen. And I think for me, that was when I saw this in the 80s. That was reason enough to keep watching. Sort of like, oh, what just happened here? This is not what you would expect from his friends, UNIT, to be shooting at the Doctor.
Because it's very different from the end of the first episode of Trowne's first story, Power of the Daleks, where, we're kind of getting on with the... Well, the Doctor's right in the middle of it, and he's kind of busy proving to us that he is actually the Doctor. At this point, I think with Pertwee, I guess we know he's the Doctor because he's done it before. But still, we really don't have a good idea of who he is at all, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We just think it's like funny John Pertwee off of the Army game.
Navy Lark.
The Navy Lark. He must have been in the Army game as well, surely.
I don't know.
Okay, don't know. All right, yeah. So, yeah, good one. Yep, definitely.
Okay. How about your first one?
Oh, my first one is, again, from Pertwee's first season, season 7. And, again, I'm slightly defaulting to cliffhangers that made an impression on me when I read them in the Target novelization. Because, obviously, this one, which is from Doctor Who and the Silurians, I didn't see until many, many years into the future. And this is the end of episode 3.
Ah.
Where John Quinn... has been discovered dead.
Right.
And that is actually, there's a marvellous illustration in the Target novelization, I think by Chris Achilleos, which has Quinn kind of like falling over backwards in this most kind of extreme way, as the Silurian's third eye that goes blah, 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 at him, which is great. It's kind of the Doctor is kind of, he's kind of solving a crime. He's like being like a detective. He's, examining a body. He's finding a strange device. He's looking around, and so he looks up and like, bam, what's standing in the doorway? It is a goddamn Silurian just standing right there.
Wow.
It's great. Oh my God. Yes.
Excellent.
Silurians.
Doctor Who and the Silurians has just so many great cliffhangers.
Yeah.
And I also chose for a Doctor Who and a Silurian, I chose end of episode 2. And like yours, it's another monster reveal. At the end of episode 3, we get the full
monster
reveal.
Yep.
But at the end of episode 2, just to set the stage, the doctor and the brigadier are in the research center underground, and the brigadier gets a call from the police saying that there's been a body of a farmer found dead in his barn, and the doctor and the brigadier and Liz all go there. They find that the body has claw marks on it, and the doctor goes, It wasn't the claw marks that killed him, it was fear.
Fear.
You know, the farmer died of a heart attack.
Died of fright, yeah. Which I'll have to say, when I used to read this as a book, and I read this book over and over again, just mm-hmm. the concept of someone dying of fear was so frightening and awesome yeah. to me. It was like, oh my God, mm-hmm. you can die of fright? It must be so frightening if you can die from it.
These monsters must be pretty amazing.
Pretty frightening.
Right. Yes. And so the doctor is informed that the farmer's wife is just beside herself, just in fear, and she's been taken to the local hospital. And so the doctor suggests to Liz that she stay behind and do some forensic work while the doctor and the brigadier go see the farmer's wife. We next see him in the hospital. The doctor does a little quick sketch with
yep.
his hand, you know, does the Silurian. The woman just freaks out, just saying, that's what killed her husband, and yeah. it's yeah. still in the barn. We go right back to the barn. We see the Silurian claw go from behind a barn door. Then we get the kind of Silurian breathing, and with the Silurian point of view, we get that monster point of view where we got the red triangle at the top. And
Siluro vision, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's in three splits, and then Liz turns around, she screams, we see this big green claw go swipe her and knock her over, and then bam, right into the credits. And I think that's a great cliffhanger, and it just sets up the stage for the episode 3 cliffhanger.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do something that's potentially quite redundant, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to read out the summaries of the cliffhanger of the Silurians here on my computer. Okay. Episode 1, the doctor is attacked by a dinosaur. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Episode yep. 2, Liz is knocked unconscious, but could he actually even be dead by a Silurian?
Right, you don't know.
You don't know, you know it. Episode 3, the doctor looks up and sees a Silurian in the doorway. Bam! Mm-hmm. Episode 4, a Silurian called Morka attacks the doctor with his third eye. Mm-hmm. Episode 5, Baker dies in the hospital as a result of the Silurian virus, and the mm-hmm. doctor says he will be the first one of millions.
Right.
Episode 6, the Silurians raid the center and kidnap the doctor. It's mm-hmm. like, whoa, it's like how many, it's like 7 episodes, mm-hmm. and it's just not drag at all. I love the Silurians. Mm-hmm. It's a no, this great, is, great, 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 great,
this
great
is an, This is Sorry. A fabulous story, and Malcolm Hulk really, really nails it with just the vibe of UNIT. The direction is amazing in this with Tim Coombe,
yep.
and the pacing. It's for a 7-part story. It really moves along, and do they not only get one monster reveal, but as you just noted, we get a monster reveal for the first 4 episodes,
yeah.
and that is one of the best cliffhangers in Doctor Who, is when you get the monster reveal.
The monster reveal, yep.
And Mac Hulk was able to milk that for 4 episodes.
Fabulous, fabulous.
Yes.
And I'm not going to turn this into like my usual rant against kind of Silurians in the new series, but you know, the Silurians in Doctor Who and the Silurians, they're godlike creatures that have mm-hmm. no care for humanity whatsoever. And they are so awesome that they basically deserve to take over the Earth. Like, they're so much better than humans in every way. Mm. And they're so alien, and they're so powerful. And they have this amazing late 1960s, early 1970s feature, which is like a third eye. I mean, you know,
they're
kind of Buddhist monsters from the beginning of time. Anyway, yeah, so, and which I think we've lost, actually, that kind of mystery and
right.
and the fact that they can just scare people to death with a right. kind of race memory of how astounding they were when we were just mm-hmm. monkeys living in trees.
Right. Anyway. They really have the otherworldliness, but the innerworldliness conveyed in that early 1970s serial
yeah.
that is something that I think I agree with you that has been lost in the Chibnall reboot of the Silurians.
Yeah, yeah. So my second cliffhanger is the demons. It's Doctor Who and the demons. The demons, whatever you want to call them. And again, I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to read out the synopsis of the cliffhangers here. Like, Demons Episode 1, the Doctor trapped inside a collapsing tunnel appears to be frozen. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Demons Episode 2, Bok prepares to attack the Doctor and Joe. That's kind of amazing. Okay, Demons Episode 3, Azal is summoned for the second time. Episode mm-hmm. 4, Azal is summoned for the third time. So I've got episode 4 where Azal is summoned for the third and final time.
Okay.
Just such an amazing build-up all the way through the demons. Again, that every one of those cliffhangers is astounding. I nearly went for episode 1 because, again...
That is an amazing cliffhanger.
Because it's like...
The Doctor's dead.
It's the Doctor's dead. It's like your first one. It's the Doctor's dead. And it also, what it does, it builds up this relationship between the Doctor and Joe, where, you know, the kind of denouement of the demons, you know, spoiler alert, is the, you know, is that Joe... threatens to sacrifice herself to save the Doctor.
Offers to
I guess I was using threatens in a kind of, you know, satirical way. Offers to sacrifice herself in the Doctor's place. Right. But, you know, that episode 1 cliffhanger, you know, she's just so upset, you know, that he's... Mm-hmm. That he's frozen. Anyway, but I mean, Azal is such, and again, I love the demon so much again because I used to read mm-hmm. the book over and over again,
right?
Which allows me to. I mean, it's almost like a what's the word? It's like a perception filter. It means I can overlay my mental images over any deficiency in the actual images I see on the screen. Mm-hmm. So it actually makes the demons and the Silurians as well like kind of hyper real to me as I watch them. And you know, this amazing Stephen Thorne's performance as Azal is astounding. The Master is amazing. And it's just really frightening because these demons are they're again like the Silurians. They are super mm-hmm. powerful,
right.
godlike creatures from the beginning of time. I mean, God knows what they can do. And the Master's playing with fire here, and he knows he's playing with fire,
right.
And we know he's playing with fire. Mm-hmm. And this is dangerous stuff. So anyway, that's why I like it.
Yeah, it's a really nice capturing of that early 1970s rural English horror that was going on.
Folk horror, yep.
Letts and Sloman did with picking up on the Wicker Man, horror.
Blood on Satan's Claw, all those great movies, yep.
I think what really sells that particular cliffhanger, the cliffhanger for episode, is it episode 4 that you chose?
Episode 4, yep.
Is the Master. Roger Delgado really sells, I think, the black mass, the satanic rituals, and with the kind of shaky camera, the Miralon images, reflected images, you get the feeling of scale on a small 1970s BBC budget.
Yeah.
And the whole production of the demons has a richness to it, and it's carried through into the cliffhangers.
And it's super confident as well. It's one of the things that I often feel can be wrong with New Who, really, mm-hmm. is that there's sometimes you really detect a lack of confidence mm-hmm. and a kind of a, like, we're desperately trying to sell you the plot or the story or the effect. Here, it's kind of balls to the wall. We don't care. We know how to do this. We're just going to do it. There's so much kind of confidence in Letts's producing of this and the direction and the actors and the effects are as good as they can make them. And if you don't mm-hmm. like them, too bad.
I wonder if it's just the confidence of, we know you're going to be able to suspend your disbelief. Our crew is suspending, you know, helping you suspend your disbelief. This is real. This is going on, rather than a lot, like in the RTD era, we had Doctor Who Confidential. As you know, as soon as Doctor Who is over, you're going to see how the smoke and mirrors were set up.
Right, right.
And in the 1970, you didn't have that.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say a simpler time, but maybe the audience was maybe less knowledgeable, perhaps, on special effects or hadn't seen it all before.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, again, you know, I mean, I think at this time, one of the extraordinary things about Doctor Who, it was the only thing on television that was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
I think on both sides of the Atlantic.
True, especially at this time.
Exactly, in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah. So
yeah,
it's
and this,
great cliffhanger.
Yeah, and this wasn't shown in the States until, I think, probably the 1980s. So,
yeah.
And in black and white.
Yeah, and in black and white, yeah.
So my next cliffhanger is, I'll go back to season 7.
Okay.
The last cliffhanger of the series, Inferno, episode 6.
Yes.
And just to set the scene here, the Doctor is in a parallel universe, so in kind of a fascist England. And Petra has just restored power, and the TARDIS console starts working. And then the brigade leader, who is Nick Courtney, playing the evil, the parallel universe, brigade leader, brigadier, pulls his gun at the doctor and demands that he is going to be taking all of them with him. The doctor says he can't. It'll cause a cosmic disaster if he does, and says the brigade leader is going to have to shoot him because he is just not going to take everyone back. And the brigade leader is counting 1, 2, 3, and then on 3, he's shot in the back by section leader Elizabeth Shaw. Then we see the whole drill site just erupt with sea lava everywhere, eruptions, the primoids are running around going bonkers, and the power levels are fluctuating, and the doctor can't go because the energy is too erratic. And then we see this giant wall of lava approaching the hut where the TARDIS console is, and the rest of the cast are watching it, and we go bam into credits then, and it's sort of like, oh, how are we going to get out of this one?
How are we going to get out of this one? Yeah, no, it's a good one. It's a good one. I was just wondering, as you were talking, like, when did... lava was such a big thing when I was a kid, and, like, mm-hmm. It was a big thing with my kids as well.
Really?
Like, when did lava become... I mean, maybe I taught them to fear lava. But I mean,
Inferno.
when did lava become such an amazing thing? I mean, were people frightened of lava like 100 years ago? I don't know.
Probably. I remember in the 1970s...
There were lots of volcanoes going off in the 1970s.
Icelandic volcanic eruptions that wiped out a town in Iceland.
And there was an island or something that grew out of the ocean or something?
Something like that. Yeah. But I just remember reading the National Geographic articles where they would have this town entombed in lava, and... the cover, I think, had just, you know, it was taken at night so you could see the red glowing lava, and it looked like the beginning of Inferno. So that memory growing up in the 70s, reinforced by National Geographic, put lava front and center as one of the things that could kill you.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously, I mean, the great thing about Inferno is that, you know, it does this kind of Star Trek, you know, alternate universe thing in a Doctor Who way. The Primords are awful and really not that good. And the main kind of enemy is lava, really, in some ways.
It's the end of the world.
The potential of the end of the world being kind of a volcanic lava eruption thing. So, I'm down with that as a great cliffhanger. You know, how do our heroes get out of that? Maybe they don't. Maybe they're trapped and die in the alternate universe.
And we only find out the Doctor does escape.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that sets up the whole resolution in episode 7. So
yeah, episode 7.
It's a good one.
It is a goodie. So my next, we are going to fast forward here quite considerably. And we're actually going to go to something that's quite extraordinary for me, because it is, I think, the first cliffhanger that I remember seeing on Doctor Who. And as some of you may remember, I'm pretty sure that my first memory of Who is the Christmas omnibus repeat of The Sea Devils. And one of my strongest memories of that omnibus repeat, which of course wasn't broken down into cliffhangers, but you could still kind of get what the most exciting bits are, was the end of episode 3. And famous, endlessly repeated cliffhanger, but it is good. Here come the sea devils emerging from the sea. The doctor that set the scene, the doctor and the master kind of sparring a bit, and there's like mines going off, and like doctor's chasing after the master, and there's a minefield, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. And then all of a sudden, what you realize is actually, you know, that the game has changed. It's no longer just the doctor versus the master. It's the Doctor versus the Master and some crazy underwater monster sea devil-y things. It's fantastic. Absolutely extraordinary. Wonderful. Love it. Love it. Here they come. And they're coming out of the sea. I mean, who knows? And I can actually remember this when I was a kid. Like, they must be real in some way, because people couldn't stay underwater that long. These can't be people dressed as monsters. These must be actual monsters.
Doctor Who hired actual monsters for the program.
Actual monsters. Because, I can remember at the time thinking to myself, I know how long I can hold my breath under the water, because I've tried it in the bathtub. And I know that those people cannot be actors. They must be real monsters.
Yeah, and they look very alien with their turtle-like look and just kind of the way they lumber about. So they are weird.
They're directed very effectively. I think the costuming is great. Mm-hmm. The idea to kind of make the head of the sea devil actually the hat that is on top of the actor's head, and they look through the neck. Makes them very oddly proportioned, which makes them perfect monsters, and it's just a very, very well done scene, and it's really kind of intimidating. As I said, it's the whole game changes, and you realize that the master's got some pretty serious allies here who are could possibly turn the tables on our heroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another Malcolm Hall cliffhanger there.
Another Malcolm Hall cliffhanger. Yeah,
a riff on his Silurian story season earlier.
Yep. I love all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a well directed story, and it I think it's a hallmark of Hulk's writing is he can really do cliffhangers, and like the very next cliffhanger I recall, isn't that the one with the diving bell where it goes down and then comes up and the doctor's not there? Joe looks in.
It is.
And you're wondering what happens to the doctor. So
it's
just the cliffhangers of this era really gets you to want to tune in next week because you gotta know what happens next.
Yes, exactly. It's like I cannot imagine. What I can imagine that happens next is so exciting that I will have to watch and see whether what I imagine is going to happen next actually is actually what is going to happen next. I mean, that's kind of how it works, basically, in a child's mind.
Well, I'm going to nip back a little bit
to
the first story of season 8. It's the second episode of Terror of the Autons. We're in just setting the scene here again. Joe has just rescued the doctor from the circus, and meanwhile, the master watches the doctor and Joe escape, and he sends one of his mind-controlled minions in. I think it's Phillips from the radio telescope,
and
he has like this grenade, and he's going to blow them up, and the doctor says, "Fight it, man, fight it," and Phillips runs out, and we hear an explosion, and we see his corpse there. And in Phillips' hand is the key of the TARDIS, or the Master's horse box disguised TARDIS. And the doctor goes in, steals the dematerialization circuit. But while he's doing that, the circus mob rushes him. We see Rossini club the doctor over the head. The doctor collapses. Joe gasp, and just in time, everything's saved. The police arrive. They push off the mob. They drag the doctor and Joe, put him in the car, and the doctor thanks the officers, and then Joe goes, why are we going to a quarry?
Because it's Doctor Who. That's where we go. Come on.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Yates and Brigadier pull up and then see the police go off. And then they go, wait a minute. And then we get a radio call from Benton saying, those aren't really the police. At the same time, the doctor goes, officer, why are we going to a quarry? Can I see your warrant card? One of the police officers turn around. The doctor looks quizzically at it, reaches up, takes off his mask, and we see the dead, cold, plastic face of an Auton. Credits. It's sort of like, whoa,
exactly. Yeah, no, it's completely unfaultable, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you think they're safe. You think that we haven't ended on a cliffhanger because they've been rescued by the police and. Oh no, these aren't the police. These are Autons.
Do you think it's is there a pattern here, cuz I chose the Silurians and then the Sea Devils, and then you chose the Autons and then the Terror of the Autons. Is that indicative of what we're finding most frightening about the early 1970s Pertwee Whos? Or
what?
There's so many great cliffhangers here. It's really, really hard to choose, to be honest.
It is. And I chose what I was trying to think back what was most memorable for me when on first watch. So I'm thinking back as a teenager watching these late at night, late Friday night, late Saturday night on public television in the Twin Cities, Minnesota. What I remembered, what made me want to get these on VHS, what made me want to record them. And these are the type of things that I remember. I remember the lava. I really remember Terror of the Autons quite clearly, with the master. And this was coming off of the Tom Baker years when the master was corpse thing.
Right.
You know, we have this very suave, debonair, handsome man who is the master, and it's sort of like that. If there was an internet at the time, it would have sent me scrambling the internet, but it is sort of like there was, the only thing I had to go on was Target novels when these things were going on, and Doctor Who magazine. So a chance copy of Doctor Who magazine and Shinders, which was a comic book news agent in the Twin Cities at the time, you know, just kind of reading that, or, you know, sort of like, who is this person? And just trying to understand the richness or the depth of Doctor Who without having reference material,
any of the
internet,
tools to do so,
and just piecing together this mystery.
Yeah, which is, you know, I mean, far be it from us to go like things used to be better in the old days, but you know, things used to be better in the old days when there, you know, when it was hard to find out about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know,
yeah,
you had
there
no
was
idea
a mystery.
What the hell was going. It was a mystery. You literally, what made cliffhangers great is like you had no idea what was going to happen next. And not only did you have no idea, you had no way to find out either, to be honest.
And that was one of the things that was kind of that was missed in the omnibus format, which is what I saw most of the. Well, I saw everything but the Tom Baker years in originally was in omnibus format. So in order for something to be really memorable, like the Doctor getting shot or the Autons or the lava, they had to work and make you pause even when you're watching an omnibus and you would see the resolution seconds later. The scene had to be vivid enough to stand out in my mind that I put two and two together later when I saw on VHS in the episodic format.
Right. Absolutely. Well, very cool. Everyone loves the Terror of the Autons. Though I have to say, I can remember this quite clearly. When I was reading this Target novelizations, initially I was very confused by the title Terror of the Autons, or Zygons, or whatever other monster.
Right.
Because I remember reading it as being that the Autons were terrified in some way.
Well, they are terrified of the Doctor.
So it was about the terror that the Autons felt for something, rather than the Autons themselves being a terror that was terrifying other people. It took me a while to kind of understand how that grammatical construction actually
and then
worked.
Why was Fang Rock so horrified?
Exactly. The terror. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so we will press swiftly on to my next cliffhanger, okay? Which is, and we are now fast forwarding to season 10. This is when I was actually watching Doctor Who full time, because having enjoyed that Christmas repeat of the Omnibus of the Sea Devils, I slammed straight into season 10. This was the first season I actually started watching Doctor Who full time, and my cliffhanger is from the closing story of that season, The Green Death. And basically, all the cliffhangers in The Green Death are amazing.
Yep.
But we're going to go for episode 2, Giant Maggots. They're down in the mine. We already know that the mine is like just the scariest place to be, because it's full of green goo that turns you green and then you die. I mean, that's scary. And I think, again, I've anecdoted about this before. You in the playground at school, we would have, you know, it was a great game. You know, you touch someone, they turn green and they die. So you chased everyone around touching them and turning them green. So the mine is obviously a very, very intimidating and horrible place already. Our heroes are kind of trapped down the mine at this point. They've already, you know, had to escape, like, plummeting lifts and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, yep.
Now what happens? What could possibly be worse than being trapped down a mine which is filled with evil green goo? There are giant maggots down there as well.
Right.
Okay, I'm sold.
Emerging from the rubble.
Emerging from the wall, exactly. Yes, what could be... And the thing is, I knew about maggots. You know, maggots were all over the place in the 70s. You know, things used to go off quite regularly. You know, you used to find, like, dead animals and things with maggots in them and stuff. So I already knew how horrible maggots were. And now there's giant ones that live inside the green goo that kills everything else. So, classic cliffhanger. Love it.
Yes. It's
frightening as hell.
Again, this is one of the best serials of cliffhangers, and I'm going to skip my number 4 and go to my 5th one, because it is from The Green Death.
Okay.
And episode 3, the end of episode 3.
Oh, yes.
So the Doctor and the Brigadier are looking at this enormous egg, this enormous maggot egg. And meanwhile, while Cliff Jones is kind of romancing and comforting Joe in front of the fire, she's really upset that Bert has died. Was there anything she could do more? Cliff is just lovely to her. They're about to kiss when they hear the doctor and the brigadier talking loudly in the corridor. They laugh, and the brigadier and the doctor burst into the room, and the brigadier says he's leaving for the night. Cliff shows him out. Meanwhile, the doctor says, Joe, you should go get some sleep. And Joe says, no, I think I'm going to stick around. And Cliff gave me this really interesting book. Dr. Jones gave me this really interesting book, so I'm going to look at it for a while by the fire.
Oh, Joe.
The doctor tries to go one more up and say, hey, I actually did make it to Metabilis 3. He holds up the big blue crystal, and Joe goes, that's nice, doctor. Yeah, I'm going to be really interested in this book now. Good night. And then we see Cliff return to the room. The doctor doc blocks Cliff and says, there's some things I want to talk about. Joe looks really, really crestfallen. And then she's sad, but then she smiles. Meanwhile, while all this is going, the giant egg hatches. A giant maggot emerges from the egg and just seems instinctively to make a beeline to Joe, who's looking through the book in front of the fire. We get a kind of a camera-eyed view from the maggot's perspective low to the ground. We see Joe's bare back, and then as the maggot kind of...
It moves in a horrible way as well. God, it like... Ugh.
Yeah, it just undulates towards her, and then we go to the credits. And it's not only a good episode, a good cliffhanger, but that those final scenes really show what this story is about. It's about the giant maggots, but really it's about the doctor and Joe saying goodbye, and Joe is growing up, and she's finding a man that she can spend time with forever rather than the doctor.
Yeah.
And the doctor's sadness and kind of jerky manipulativeness to try to prevent this from happening.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we kind of have the cliffhanger with the doctor and Joe's relationship, but we also have the cliffhanger with the monster with the giant maggot bearing down on Joe's bare back.
Yeah. And she's wearing that awesome, like, you know, early 70s kind of evening dress, which is kind of, again, really places it in the time where it is. And, you know, again, I can't think of another instance, certainly at that time, where not only... it's not a girl being threatened by a giant maggot, which, you know, is a phrase that was never said before, you know, in the history of the universe until this show came out.
Right.
You know, but it's Joe, and Joe is actually, you know, people, I think we've kind of got over the kind of original ideas about Joe, that she was a weak character and spent a lot of time screaming and blah, 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 because she didn't. She's an incredibly strong character. She's incredibly brave, very intelligent, huge amount of agency, a very, very strong and fully realized character who, you know, fully for no fault of her own, you know, she's not put herself in danger by being stupid or anything.
No.
She's being threatened by a beast that we have never, that we couldn't even conceive could have existed until this show. So, yeah, well, it's great.
It's the enemy that the doctor brought back to the Nut Hutch himself.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a really good companion exit story, probably the best that we've seen since The Chase.
Yeah, it's so fully realized all the way through. Mm-hmm. And the other great thing about the Green Death is there's more than one villain.
True.
Yeah. You know, it's we have, you know, the actual final cliffhanger, we know the final cliffhangers are to do with Boss, you know, which has got nothing to do with the maggots at all. And it's just really good. Yeah, the Green Death is just really a great one. Really,
Big
really
computer,
great one.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, what's next?
So I have my number five is we are now in season 11. Joe has now gone up the Amazon, been taken up the Amazon by Dr. Jones. and the fabulous, absolutely fabulous young journalist, Sarah Jane Smith, has joined the Doctor.
Yep.
And, oh my God, what's happening? They are on an alien planet. It's Death of the Daleks, part one. Cliffhanger. Daleks emerge from the spaceship. Daleks open fire.
And we don't know.
We don't know. Everyone gets killed, presumably, because that's what happens when Daleks open fire at you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, yes. I'm a big fan of Death of the Daleks. I know a lot of people don't like it, and it kind of fizzles out at the end in the kind of most wonderful way. It just kind of like gives up and like, okay, the story's over now. But the whole build-up thing is fabulous. It's mysterious and it's creepy, and the planet is scary, and the TARDIS is malfunctioning, and everyone's in a bad mood. And then all of a sudden, you know, the kind of kitchen, kind of pressure cooker, whatever it's called, you know, crock pot arrives from space. The Daleks crock pot flies down, lands. Out come the Daleks, and it's Daleks. I mean, we knew there were going to be Daleks in it because it is called Death of the Daleks.
Tin.
it does what it says on the tin, but it is actually always cool when the Daleks turn up, even when they signal themselves by calling their show about themselves or using their names to title their own show. But they turn up, and you know, they're not, you know, obviously Daleks do not screw around. These are some fully Daleks with full Dalek agency. They're not going to capture the Doctor and torture him, and they're not going to capture the Doctor and like interrogate him. They're not going to like pretend to be the Doctor's friend as a trick and then kill him later on. They're going to come straight out of the spaceship, and they're going to fire the guns, and he's going to be dead, and they're going to be rulers of the universe.
Yep. Yep.
But anyway,
but we'll find out the guns don't work.
Guns don't work, exactly.
And we see how much the Daleks are obsessed with the Doctor a little bit later with their little TARDIS target practice.
Which they carry, which is standard equipment on all Dalek sources. Like, oh, we hate this man so much. Ah.
It's the way that, you know, back in Power, the Dalek knew who the Doctor was. The Doctor knows who the Daleks is, and the Daleks know who the Doctor is.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's presumably, I don't know, it's echoes of the Time War. You know, the Daleks have always been fighting the Doctor and vice versa.
So I'm going to compare this to the series earlier, The Planet of the Daleks cliffhanger. And this is a cliffhanger that I reviewed, and I was thinking about making it my final cliffhanger.
Okay.
But it came a little short, and it's the end of episode 3 when the Doctor and the Thals are trying to escape in the hot air balloon.
That is a good cliffhanger, actually, yeah.
But the direction, I don't know if it's the direction or Terry Nation's writing, they aren't actually escaping yet. The cliffhanger is they can't get off the ground.
Right.
And beginning of part 4, we see they do get off the ground, and I think a better cliffhanger in that sense would have been the Dalek is rising up after them. So it's a race
to
see who's going to escape. And compare that to the cliffhanger that you have in Death to the Daleks, where the Daleks just, bam, they come out of the spaceship and fire. That has a much more immediacy, much more peril, and it makes a much better cliffhanger.
It does, it does. And it's. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, these Daleks, they're not screwing around.
Right.
You know, they're not going to... They've kind of signaled that they're not going to be part of any kind of plot that we might have thought they might have been involved in. They're just going to come out firing, and they're going to kill everybody, and then they're going to get... And then they're going to get on with whatever they came to the planet to do. Mm-hmm. They're not going to capture you and then explain their evil plan. They're not going to explain their evil plan to anybody. They're just going to kill everybody and then do their evil plan.
Right.
Which actually, Daleks don't often... and obviously, you know, it doesn't happen because their guns don't work. villains don't often do that. And the only reason these villains do
this...
Well,
the Master always faps about...
Exactly. You know, and the only reason these villains are allowed to act in a truly villainous manner is because we know that... Because they can't actually kill our...
Right, they're impotent at this point.
Our heroes. But it's actually Daleks acting in the way that Daleks should do, which is like, you know, kill everyone first, then do your evil plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, that's why I like it. And again, the Death of the Daleks is good. It's a really gutsy. It starts off so well. It's got such a great gutsy title. You know, Death to the Daleks. It should have an exclamation mark on the end of it, which I don't think it does, but it should do. You know, it's really grim and gritty, and people get sacrificed maybe. And then they escape, and then the whole thing kind of like grinds to a, you know, they just kind of give up at the end. But anyway, yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you had a bonus one.
Have you done all your 5?
I think so. Let me just see. I did the Spearhead from Space.
Yeah.
And then the Silurians, Inferno,
Yeah.
Terror of the Autons, and then the Green Death.
That is five. I did the Silurians, the Demons, Sea Devils, Green Death, and Death to the Daleks. Mm-hmm. I do have a couple of bonus. We want to do a couple of bonus ones. That's fine by me.
Sure. Yeah, that's great. It's a great era. So.
So I've got two ones, and I'll do them quickly because, again, I mean, you can pick anyone in this mm-hmm. era, and they'll be good cliffhangers. First right. one, and this is a again. I mean, everyone knows I'm a huge Mac Hulk fan, so I always mm-hmm. champion Mac Hulk stories. We're going to go straight back to season 8, and we are going to go to the colony in space, where it is, okay. the colony. That's where it is. It's in space. And we're going to do episode 1, IMC Robot, advances to kill the Doctor. Doctor like, here comes the robot. And here comes the robot.
It's is that great. The one with the big claws?
The big clawed robot, yeah. Big clawed robot.
Oh,
yeah. Because those IMC people, they're Scooby-Doo villains. They're dressing up as a monster in order to, like, scare the colonists or something.
Now, that's the first time we've had that. And is it? The only time we've had that in Doctor Who, isn't it?
It is. No, I mean, the Doctor Who villains don't often act like Scooby-Doo villains at all.
Right.
They're usually a lot more upfront. But, I mean, I'm a big fan of IMC. IMC should mm-hmm. be in the show a lot more because they're excellent. They're excellent enemies. And the colonists are so weak and washy and kind of like, you know, 1970s. I mean, they're basically... You know,
it would have been really cool if the mining company in Oxygen from the series 10 would have been IMC.
They just should have called it IMC, and that would have made me very, very happy. So I'm basically the colonists. I mean, they're basically the nuthatch out of Green Death transformed into space. And I just, and again, I love Colony in Space because it's called Colony in Space, which is such a boring title. But anyway, so that's my first one. I think that's a great cliffhanger.
So I have one here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Just one backup. And it's from The Time Monster, episode 3. Mm. And the Time Monster always gets the stick. And I'm not sure. Well, I do know the complaints against it, but it has a soft spot for me. I'd like it.
It's good.
And this particular cliffhanger, I like the time scoopiness of what the Master's doing to slow down or thwart UNIT. And this was...
Throw various things from time right, at them to, like, right. slow their progress towards right. where he is. Yes.
It's interesting. And
it's a good tactic.
It's a good tactic, and the Mike Yates convoy is waylaid by English roundheads.
Any number of strange things from history, exactly.
Right, and Mike goes to throw a grenade at the roundheads, and they vanish, and the Master kind of chuckles, looking at them with his, I'm guessing, Apple Watch or something like that. And the coup de grace for the Master is he sends a V1 from World War II down on the convoy, and the Doctor goes, they're chasing after the convoy. And the Doctor goes, oh, no, it can't be. And the Brigadier immediately recognizes the sound of the doodle bug.
Yeah.
And the Brigadier sets it up saying, if that engine cuts out, they're in trouble. The engine cuts out.
They're in
and,
trouble.
He's trying to raise Yates on the walkie-talkie saying, it's a bomb, man. It's a bomb. Get out. We see Yates' convoy go behind some trees. A big explosion, a little mushroom cloud goes out.
Very little one.
The radio goes silent, and one of the few times the Brigadier calls Mike Yates by his first name, Mike, and Brigadier's going, Mike, can you hear me? We end.
Yeah.
Good use of peril. It's not on set. It's out on location. Pretty decent explosion. And I really like the idea of the Master using Time Scoop to throw obstacles in the way of UNIT.
Yeah, no, it's great. And the only thing that always slightly irritates me about that particular scene in The Time mm-hmm. Monster is that the obvious use of stock footage, which is it's in black and white, which wouldn't matter if you're watching the telly in black right. and white, but you're watching it in mm-hmm. color. So it's like, oh, hang on. So wow, that's amazing. So back in the past, the past actually took place in black and white. That makes sense. So that's why it's black
and white. Our kids tease us that we grew up with black and white television, so color wasn't invented. And we
No, there was no color.
It was all black and white back when we were kids.
Purely monochrome world, exactly. A purely monochrome world. But no, it's a great cliffhanger, and you know, the Master is just super evil in this, and he's being silly. He's like he's it's like the kind of silly master, you know. It's like, you know, he's not.
It's camp.
You know,
he could. Camp.
He's super camp. I mean, he could just get like an atomic bomb or something and like just blow that up on them, and that would really stop Mike Gates.
Well, no, because he's locked to that geographic region. So the doodlebug.
Oh, is that?
Yeah. So that was my interpretation, because in the resolution we said the farmer, the yokel, said, "Oh yeah, we had something." A doodlebug land here in 1944.
Right. So it's got to be things that happened on that road.
On that road, in that location in the past. So that's why we have the night charging.
Makes sense.
And then we have the roundheads and... Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he could have dropped a nuke, but they're not in Sheffield.
Could he not have time-skewed something from the future?
Well, that's why I'm saying they're not in Sheffield.
Oh, that's true. But like from the far, anyway. Yeah, no, it's great. It's super camp. I mean, the Master's a Bond. He's a Bond villain. Basically, my take on Time Monster, it's basically Doctor Who the movie, and you know, because
it
has movie stars in it. It's got, you know, what's the name from Ingrid Pitt. It's got David Prowse as the Minotaur, you know, everyone's in it, and the Master, he's basically full on Bond villain,
right?
He's just not serious at all about actually killing his adversaries. He just toys with them,
right?
He's like, you know, he's completely camp and Bond villainy, and it's a great one. Yeah, definitely.
So what's your last backup one?
So the last backup one my mind's gone blank. Carnival of Monsters, Giant Hand.
Oh, yeah, reaching down for the TARDIS.
Because at that point, you really don't, because there's not really been a huge amount of there's been no connection between what's going on, you know, the planet of the Grey People and the Doctor and Joe, who appear to be on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically, that's all that's going on. And actually, I can remember watching the first episode of this and being like, I don't know what's going on. I might actually not be enjoying this.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Giant Hand comes down and bam, it's Doctor Who.
Yep. That's Vorg's hand. And the thing that always strikes me about that is, boy, does he have dirty fingernails.
Well, there you go. Yeah, it's very millicitude down to the last.
Yeah, it's
dirty fingered showman.
Leslie Dwyer is not a hand model, but I don't think it's actually his hand. It's probably some special effects guy,
Matt Irvin's hand or someone. Exactly. Tucker's hand.
It's probably a craftsman or an artist's hand where, you know, you get some paint and some goo underneath the nails.
Yeah, painting TARDIS is blue all day. You're gonna get some paint under your nails.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that story ends with Sherry Hall's smile. That's always a good ending.
It's always a good ending. And you know, as I said, Carnival of Monsters, it's a pretty sophisticated tale. But you know, like all of these great early 70s Whos, you know, it's got monsters, it's got satire, it's got danger, it's got peril, it's got comedy, you know. It's got it all. I mean,
It's a great Bob Holden script.
I mean, I was going to do when the Drashigs come, like, leaping out of the, you know, with the waving their heads in the air, like they're, you know, like they're doing a little dance.
Mm-hmm. Scariest puppets in Doctor Who.
And again, I can remember watching this and thinking to myself, like, how do they do that? I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they must be real animals in some way, because I can't understand how that would happen on screen without them being real animals.
And their scream was really weird.
Oh my God, those horrible dog mouths. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, I mean, I how old would I have been? What date is this? Like 1972, 1973. So, you know, I'm like 7 or 8 or something. And I was absolutely convinced by every aspect of the show at this point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I remember thinking, like, I can't imagine, I don't know what the Drashigs are. I literally don't know what's going on here.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway.
Yep, just an era that is just chock full of great cliffhangers.
Yep, it's cliffhanger central, basically. And it's just, I think it's a sad, it's a sad indictment of our contemporary society. No, it's not. It's one of the sad things about New Who, which is so much to commend it, is that, you know, the structure of contemporary television really kind of negates the cliffhanger. It's a hard thing to do.
And you would think with the binge-watching type era that these things are often made for the home media market, where you're going to watch it all in one go or watch it over several nights. The original broadcast is not the primary form of consumption. That only happens once. But once it's on the shiny disc, once it's on a streaming service, you would think that maybe the cliffhanger would have a little more appeal. But maybe we'll see that under Chibnall, where
maybe we will
have series-wide arc where stories might be strung together with a cliffhanger.
Yeah, no, I guess we'll see. Well, that was so much fun to talk about Pertwee cliffhangers.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for listening to episode 73 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been having a delightful conversation with Ben.
And I have been having a fabulously cliffhanger-esque conversation with David.
All right.
And we will speak to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening.
Good night.
Good night. So confusing.
It is confusing. Yeah, we're confused by our own podcast here. God knows what our listener is doing at this point. Banging their head slowly against the wall, possibly.
Guys, get it together.
What? Who? And then that happened.